A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights are probably gone.
So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 59. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television. And today we are talking about 1984. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
1984, of course, is a famous book by George Orwell from the late 1940s. And it was adapted as a television production by Nigel Neal, who we know as a favorite writer and showrunner from British Invaders.
Absolutely. We're big fans of Nigel Neal here. And this adaptation of George Orwell's book was broadcast by the BBC and it went out in 1954, so just 5 years after Orwell's book was published. And the television adaptation we're going to be talking about is a very famous, almost infamous moment in British broadcasting history. And as we'll discuss later on, it was quite controversial at its time, still has some resonance to this day.
Yes, it was controversial, and it was also a big moment in terms of the things that they were doing on television and that they could do on television. It was quite a move forward. So the background of this, of course, is Eric Arthur Blair, better known as George Orwell, lived from 1903 to 1950, and he wrote the novel 1984 in 1947 and 48. It was published in 49. I believe he had the original idea and was first talking about it in 1944, but it was later in the 40s that he wrote it and it was actually published.
Okay. And soon after he published it, I think the BBC purchased the rights very quickly. They clearly identified that it was a major piece of literature. And they put a writer called Hugh Fawkes on to the project of adapting the script. And of course, after Orwell's death in 1950, he worked on this and he worked with Orwell's widow, Sonia, on an early version of the script.
And the project was then handed over to Rudolf Cartier, who was a director and producer. And Cartier had worked with Nigel Neal recently at that point. So Cartier brought Nigel Neal into the project. And it was Nigel Neal who wrote the adaptation of the book that was actually used for the production.
Yeah, that's right. I think Cartier had a few problems with the original script from Hugh Fawkes. And of course, as you say, Brian, he was very familiar with working with Nigel Neal because perhaps most famously at the time, they just collaborated on the Quatermass experiment, which had been broadcast in 1953. Another very famous moment in British science fiction television history, which you and Zander discussed way back in the early stages of British Invaders, I believe.
That's right, we did. And Cartier and Neal were a really hot team at the time. They changed how television drama was done in many ways, and they really used the medium more flexibly and more playing to the medium than just pointing some cameras at what was otherwise a stage play. And that worked well. They made some good steps with it in the Quatermass experiment, and I think they moved it even further forward with 1984.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, as has been said before, probably Cartier and Nigel Neal in the 1950s, they practically created British television as its own genre, as opposed to, as you say, just previously being like televising plays directly on the screen.
For drama, I think you're right, yeah.
And Rudolf Cartier had done an adaptation of Wuthering Heights for the BBC the year before as well, I believe. And I suspect with his success with the Quatermass experiment and then with Wuthering Heights, the BBC saw that he could do science fiction and literary adaptations. And I think that's probably why he was given 1984 and then got to bring in Nigel Neal.
That's probably true. This was a time of sort of new up-and-coming writers and directors and producers with BBC drama, because the whole field of doing this on television was so new and so young at that time. So it was generally a lot of fairly young guys there working to shape this new medium into something.
Okay. So we should talk about the story of 1984.
Yes, and it's worth pointing out that now 1984, the book, is a classic, and it's very well known to us, but I don't think it was quite so well known and quite so high profile back in the 50s, in 1954, when this drama went out.
I think that's really interesting because, you know, as you say, Brian, we've all read 1984, and it features on so many sort of school English literature courses. But in 1954, I wonder how many people had come across the book. Obviously, it had some, you know, notoriety when it was published, and the BBC had jumped on it to buy the rights. But a lot of people who are watching this must not have been familiar with the actual the plot.
And I think when we go on to talk about some of the controversy around this, that becomes evident that people didn't know what to expect from 1984. It was not this classic, you know, one of the major novels of the 20th century that it has become with time.
Yeah, absolutely. So in 1984, as we know well now, it's set in a future Britain, which has survived an atomic war. Britain is now known as Airstrip One and is ruled by an absolutely ruthless political organisation known as INGSOC, which is short for English Socialism, which has quite an iron grip on the country. It rules the country, it controls the people, and perhaps most importantly for part of the plot, it rewrites the history of the country to suit its own ends, and it's constantly doing this as it goes along. And although it's set in the year 1984, I think it is referenced a couple of times that it may not even be 1984 because the calendars may have been changed and history and dates may have been changed as they went along.
Yes, that's right. Everything, all information is manipulated. And INGSOC is like this concept of English socialism that sort of rules everything and is meant to be what is the control and what's behind everything. And we also find out very early that we're in a society that is very heavily rationed. We have food rations, we have alcohol rations, sex and literature are rationed and controlled. Everything about people's actions and what they can have, what they can do, all of these things are restricted and rationed.
That's right. And then as well as rationing various items and various concepts, they also have to control the population as well. And they do that in a variety of ways.
Yes, they do that. A big part of it is with these hate concepts, that they have hate figures and something called the two-minute hate that is forcing people to put all of their aggression into a specific direction, and this idea of the figure of Emmanuel Goldstein, who is the enemy and controls this group called the Brotherhood. At least people are told he is the enemy and controls this group, and everyone is forced to focus hatred against this.
And they also had other bits of popular culture which were all manufactured by the party just basically to subdue the masses and keep quiet. So they had computer generated songs which are distributed, and computer generated literature, and even pornographic pulp fiction is sort of put out by computers controlled by the party and just given to keep the masses happy.
Yes, so you end up with something where the masses are occupied by these songs and these books which we know are inherently meaningless, but they focus on them anyhow. And there is also a lottery that the masses participate in and constantly buy tickets for, but no one seems to ever win it. But again, it's something that is put there to control and to occupy people.
And over all of this, there is the reassuring political figure of Big Brother, the apparently the leader of the party, who is never seen apart from on posters, and who's mentioned in broadcasts, and his announcements, proclamation are given out. And he seems to be the controlling figure and a reassuring figure that also helps to keep everybody in check.
And we are famously told Big Brother is watching. And this is something that has become known very much to us now, associated with 1984, is the idea of pervasive surveillance, that Big Brother is always watching, that every room almost has surveillance devices. So almost everywhere anyone goes, they are being watched and their actions are being tracked, and they cannot do anything without being discovered.
It's interesting that recently we discussed the 1960s show The Prisoner, which had a big theme about surveillance and the prisoner always being watched. And yet it all seems to sort of come back and start here with Orwell's 1984, when we first really, I think, got this idea of the surveillance society. So an interesting connection there with some of the other stuff we discussed on British Invaders.
Yes, absolutely. It was tremendously influential, and we'll talk about that later too.
And so many other aspects of the novel and the adaptation have just sort of gone on into, modern ideas and culture and references. And so we often talk about Big Brother or a Big Brother society. Orwell introduced the concept of the thought crime, so that even thinking about something that was deemed illegal by the party would become a crime. And of course, those sorts of crimes were pursued by the thought police. And so much of this stuff, Brian, it's just like in modern usage, we just refer to these things all the time.
That's right.
Of course, you know, it's a constant refrain, and we won't be the first ones to make it, that more and more modern society becomes sort of resemble Orwell's nightmarish visions from this book.
Yes. You hear so many references to it directly or indirectly.
It's difficult to think of another book that is so frequently referenced in modern sort of language and culture and in our media and in politics. You know, it's hard to imagine a book more influential than 1984.
That's true. And we get these ideas of the telescreens, which are like televisions of a sort, but they watch you as well as allowing you to watch something. So they become the overt part of this pervasive surveillance, and they also will show visuals and will have messages talking to people, sometimes to individuals, and you get this idea that you have to do what the telescreen says, or else the thought police will come to get you. So this idea of the terror of the thought police is also central to this book and to the adaptation we're looking at here from Nigel Neill and Rudolf Carche.
Yes, absolutely.
And of course, we also get the idea of the population being divided into the inner party, the outer party, and the proles, where the proles are the masses, 85% of the population, and they are treated almost like cattle. You know, they're sort of treated as being mindless, and they just feed them these mindless songs and books and lotteries that don't work and things, and the proles will just be busy because of that. Then you have the outer party, which is where most of the main characters are from, and they're considered more intelligent and are more involved in what is happening and have more privileges. And then there are the elite. The real elite is the inner party, which is a very small number of people who have apparently more power and maybe the ones pulling the strings. We don't understand entirely what happens in the inner party.
No, it is all a bit mysterious. We don't know exactly who has the power, except to say that it's clear that the proles and the outer party don't have it.
Yes, and privileges are very much separated. So just about anyone can go to the places that the proles go, but the proles can't go to outer party or inner party places and so on. Privileges are different. The rations of how much of anything people can have are different. The types of food and supplies are different. So the really good food is only available to the inner party. The outer party gets sort of mediocre canned kinds of things, and the proles get, well, very poor quality stuff in comparison.
Your technical fault has been put right?
Yes, I'm able to go on now.
In his broadcast speech last night, Big Brother referred in confident terms to the probability of a full-scale Eurasian offensive early next month. There is now no possible doubt, he said, that it will take place in North Africa. Other fronts are expected to remain quiet.
An extraordinary error. The speech was evidently misreported.
Grossly misreported, since the offensive, in fact, came in India.
South India, 3 days ago.
Exactly. Such a careless report must not exist.
Okay, well, you've mentioned the characters, so we should go on to start talking about them. And of course, the first one is the most famous character, the lead character of the book, Winston Smith, a member of the Outer Party. He's working on rewriting what the party call inaccuracies in newspaper reports. So basically, he gets to rewrite whenever they want to correct a bit of history to suit themselves in the inner party. And Winston Smith was played by Peter Cushing, extraordinarily famous British actor, most famous, I suppose, for his Hammer horror film, but also for playing Moff Tarkin in the very first Star Wars movie. And he was quite young. This was a fairly early role for him. I think he'd just turned 40 or in his early 40s when he did this, Brian.
Something like that. It was definitely much younger than we've seen him in his other roles, most of his Hammer horror films. He was even the Doctor. Peter Cushing starred in the two Doctor Who Dalek movies that were done in the 1960s. They weren't part of the series Doctor Who. They weren't canon Doctor Who, if you will. They weren't part of continuity. But he starred in those too, so he is, as you say, very well known. And this was an early role for him.
Yes, so very early on, and a very impressive TV performance. And he was playing against another character, Julia, again a member of the Outer Party, a member of something called the Anti-Sex League. And she, as we see in the film, is operating one of the computers that generates this sort of pulp pornographic fiction. And she was played by an actress called Yvonne Mitchell, who Cartier had actually previously directed as Kathy in Wuthering Heights the year before, so obviously had worked with her and was used to her and brought her across to this production.
And then we have O'Brien, who is a senior member of the inner party. He's basically the only inner party member that we come across here, and he seems to take an interest in Winston Smith. And we don't entirely understand why, but we know there is something between them, and things play out from there. O'Brien was played by André Morel, who went on to play Professor Quatermass in Quatermass and the Pit, the BBC version from 1958 and 59. So that was also a very good performance. And André Morel went on to be in various films as well. I believe he was in Bridge on the River Kwai. So that was also a nice performance in here.
It is a fantastic performance by André Morel as O'Brien. And as you say, I think he went on to be, he said he was my favorite Quatermass.
Yes. There were a number of very strong performances in this. In our next episode about 1984, we'll talk a bit more about our reactions to it and our feelings about it. And we'll certainly be talking about some of the performances. You also had Syme, who was a co-worker working with both Winston and Julia, more with Winston, and he is working on the Newspeak dictionary. We haven't really talked about Newspeak yet, but it's this sort of abbreviated, shortened version of English, or simplified version of English, that people are being told to use. And Syme is an expert on that, and he has a very interesting role in this too, and certainly at a number of specific parts of it has some very good moments, so good performance from him too. And Syme was played by Donald Pleasence, who also went on to work in various films. I always remember him as the villain from the James Bond film. He was Blofeld in You Only Live Twice.
He's probably the most famous representation of Blofeld, isn't he?
Maybe.
Yes, I always remember him as Dr. Loomis in Halloween as well.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, but another famous actor.
And we also have Parsons, who is a relentlessly cheerful supporter of the party and a big brother, and also a co-worker with Syme and Julia and Winston. And he seems a little bit dull as a person, and he's someone who has sort of been taken in by all of these things that is put forward by the inner party, and we're led to believe by Big Brother. So he is a believer, and he was played by Campbell Gray.
Yes, I think you've got that right, Brian. He is a believer, isn't he? He clearly toes the party line. He believes it, and not only does he believe it, he enjoys it all, and he's tremendously cheerful, whereas Winston Smith and Syme are slightly more gloomy, and perhaps, as we learn as things go along, may have some doubt.
Yes, Parsons is the one that we know absolutely for sure is a believer through and through.
Hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah. The others, pretty well from the beginning, we know there are question marks. Now, of course, there's a lot more to say about the characters in the story, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But let's get into some of the production side of things, because it's fun to take a good look at that as well. We already mentioned that this was produced and directed by Rudolph Cartier, and the adaptation was by Nigel Neal, and it was quite a close adaptation to the book. He used quite a bit of text from the book, and he really kept the story and most of the world that Orwell built, he really kept most of it quite close, and at the same time made it work quite well in a dramatic format and made it work very well for screen. So that was really nice to see from Nigel Neal.
Yes, it's a fantastic adaptation by Neal. As you say, works very well for television. And it was all planned to be a live broadcast by the BBC, which, as you and Zander discussed right back at the start of British Invaders, was standard practice for 1950, that these things were done live. If recordings exist, we're lucky to have them, because most of them weren't recorded.
It sounds very strange to us now to do live television broadcasts, to have the actors performing the drama while it is being broadcast out to televisions in people's homes. That seems very strange to us now. But in the 50s, that was really normal. It was how things were done. And there were good reasons that it was done that way, because the transmission was done with video, but recording could only be done with film. So if you wanted to record something first, you had to do it on film, and then essentially point a camera at a film projection to broadcast it. It was a little bit more complicated than that, but not a lot more complicated. And it meant that doing things so they were pre-recorded really didn't work as well. It just wasn't as flexible. And the end result, even on the small televisions people had in the early 50s and the mid-50s, even then, the pre-recorded things just didn't look as good as when they were doing it live. Because when they did it live, it was straight through with video. There was no film involved.
And also, as we've said, there was this, you know, British television was moving from theatre towards this new medium. And so they were used to doing these things live to a certain extent. And I think a lot of the directors and actors were used to this, and that's where they'd come from, a theatrical background.
That's true.
But as you say, Brian, they did have some pre-filmed inserts, which they needed to have because they wanted to do some outdoor scenes, and I think also because the pre-filmed inserts allow the cast and crew on the live set to move around and to move cameras, to move sets while one of these pre-filmed inserts is being broadcast. And so some of those were filmed in advance at Alexandra Palace in London, and others in other bits of I think there was a ruined estate near one of the studios which they used for some of the scenes in the Prol, in the places where the Proles live.
They were mostly sort of transitional scenes, weren't they? It was very often you'd have someone walking outside from one building to another or something like that, or maybe two people or someone being chased. They get a little bit more complicated, but they tended to be fairly simple things that were transitional without very much of any dialogue and sort of moving from one place to another.
Yes, that's right. And they do have, as you say, they have a slightly spooky sort of ghostly look to them. They're not quite as clean as the actual live broadcast stuff.
Well, I think what we're seeing now when we look at the recording we have now is they filmed these inserts, then they put them, then they converted to video for transmission by basically pointing a camera at a film projection screen, but then the whole drama was recorded from a video monitor to film in order to keep it for later use or for posterity. You end up with a film of a video of a film for those segments.
We're seeing something that's sort of third or fourth hand.
That's right. Which, again, seems odd or seems the wrong way of doing it now. But at the time, that's how you did it. That's how things worked. That was the technology they had.
Yep, that's what they did. So they had to get a big cast and crew together, Brian.
Yes, they did. And they assembled at BBC Limegrove Studios, which later became the home of Doctor Who, among other things. And they went from there with actors and sets being used for a live broadcast from there. And they did a series of rehearsals quite extensively leading up to the initial broadcast. And that was something that was very much more part of the culture of doing things at the time, was very much like a play, in that you would do a full set of rehearsals so that the actors, or theatrical actors generally, could pull something off where they would do an entire production live from end to end, which is different from the way things are done now, where they don't rehearse things ahead of time. They sort of rehearse a little bit as they go along, or just record things and keep re-recording them until they look good.
Yeah, lots of rehearsals, because they had to get this right on the night, didn't they?
Yes, they had lots of rehearsals, because I think there was quite a bit riding on this production. It was a big production.
It was, yes, a very big production of the BBC. And the night in question was Sunday, December the 12th, 1954. And at some time after, just shortly after 8:30, they started this production. And the whole thing ran for just under 1 hour and 50 minutes, I think, on the first screening. But as we said, this was quite an involved task for everybody.
Yes, it was a very big production. It involved 17 different sets, which for a live production at the time was enormous. And it was basically the biggest production that the BBC had attempted up to that time. So this was really quite complex and quite involved. And I think at that time, running for an hour and 50 minutes, I think that was relatively long for a television play on the BBC. I'm not certain of that, but I think that was fairly long.
It does seem quite long, doesn't it? You know, as a time, yes, for a time slot for television in that era.
And they went through this whole thing with all of these different sets being set up, and the cast and crew would have to move from set to set quite a bit, which is why they needed these filmed inserts, because with 17 sets, you can't just step from one to the other while the camera's looking at someone else or something like that. You have to have these gaps so people can run around from one set to another if they're in consecutive scenes. And they also had special effects, in almost the theatrical sense of special effects, that had to be operated live. So they would have, for example, the telescreens, with things being projected, back projected onto the telescreens, and little lights running on the telescreens and things like that, that would be running while they were doing this live and while the actors were acting and reacting to these things going on with the telescreen, and voices coming in from voice actors live doing this as well. So it was a pretty complex production.
It's remarkable to think about it, really. I mean, we mentioned the theatrical nature of television in the 50s, but it's like a theatre company, isn't it, Brian? They must have all been running around backstage, actors trying to get to their marks, trying to move cameras in times, and these special effect guys running around trying to keep all these little bits and pieces going for the next shot.
Yes, when we think about it now, we look at this production and say, well, it's not that complex by modern standards, and there are all these very sort of simple things that they did. But if you look at the technology that was available at the time, and what they had to do at the time, the facilities they had to use, and the fact that it was being done live, it was a pretty complex and impressive production.
Absolutely. And to add to that, also live was the orchestra, and that a composer called John Hotchkiss had composed the music for 1984, and he conducted the orchestra playing the music in an adjoining studio, Studio E at Lime Grove, and they were playing it live, following the action on a closed circuit television, so they could keep up with what was going on.
And someone must have been controlling a mixer of some sort to make sure that the music was in balance with the dialogue and wasn't too loud or wasn't too quiet, being done on the fly. So involved stuff.
And as we've said, it was broadcast on December the 12th, 1954, and it was there was another broadcast, which again was a live broadcast, on December the 16th, 4 days later. And this time we're fortunate that it was actually recorded by this slightly complicated process of tele-recording, more or less pointing a camera at a television screen. And it was recorded on 35mm film. And we'll talk a little bit more about that second performance in our next episode.
That's right. And it was, in fact, a complete second performance. So the actors performed everything again, and the orchestra performed everything again. again everything they had to do the first time, except creating the filmed inserts. Everything had to be done a second time.
And the special effects chaps running around behind the sets.
Absolutely. And apparently Peter Cushing said that the first performance, the one that was not recorded, was the better one.
Yes, again, we have one of those British Invaders rumors, don't we? That the one we can't watch was the more impressive one.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no way we can judge that now. No. And that's one of the actors deciding that which one was better. And maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. It depends on your perspective, I suppose. So next time on British Invaders, we will continue our discussion of 1984. We will talk about more of the story, give you a little bit more of the feel of what they did. We'll talk about the reaction to it and some of the controversy that surrounded it, because there certainly was quite a bit, and some of the issues about the second broadcast.
And we'll also touch on the other adaptations of 1984 over the years in various different media. And we'll get on to our review and our thoughts about this television adaptation that we've been watching and that we hope you'll be able to watch too.
There is definitely lots more to talk about, so please come and listen to our second half on this. You can reach us at britishinvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.britishinvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. Please join us next time. This is goodbye from Eamon in England.